Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. My guest this evening is Stephen Simon, and some of you may know that name and some of you may not, but when we talk about the movies that he has produced and directed, I think you will know exactly who he is. And we are going to have a wonderful time talking about the movie industry, what movies mean, the spirituality of movies, and who knows what else. It's great fun talking to Stephen. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And I thought I'd think a little bit about experiences like movies. There's when you talk to people about how the mind works and you listen to people that study that, they say that there's really no difference between what comes in through your senses and what happens in your imagination. And what does that mean? Your brain processes what you imagine, what you fear, what you make up in your mind, what you see for yourself, in exactly the same way as if it was coming from the physical world. And even psychic phenomena, when they've done brain studies of people who are clairaudient, people who hear voices, who are not crazy, they're really hearing things. The part of their brain that lights up, that's being used when they report having that experience, is exactly the same part of the brain that is used when you're hearing things in the physical world. And similarly for people that have psychic sight, the part of the brain that lights up is the vision center. So it's a real phenomenon in some way. The brain takes it in and processes it as being the same as coming from the physical world. And there's a saying that all realities are dreams and all dreams are realities. And it's really talking to a certain extent, although it's much broader than that, about this phenomenon. That if it's your experience, however that experience is coming in, you will take that in and that will be true for you. If it's an internal experience, it will create your external experience. If it's an external experience, it informs what you believe is true of the world, and then you take that and you create your external experience, both from what you believe and from the choices you make. So what does that have to do with movies? A long, long time ago, a real smart guy named Plato came up with this idea of vicarious catharsis. Isn't that a great phrase? What he meant was that if you can, in your imagination, in some way, fully comprehend, fully experience what someone else has gone through, that you can learn that lesson and not have to do it yourself. In effect, you can bypass needing to go through all those experiences to have the understanding. Of course, as somebody who's got a teenage daughter, that's exactly what I want her to do, obviously. I want her not to make the mistakes that I and everybody else when we were teenagers made. I want her to somehow take it in from me, understand it, and not have to do that. But aside from that little amusing perspective, one of the things about film, about the movie experience, is that if you're sitting in a dark room with a screen that takes your full visual field and now with intense surround sound, which is clearer than what you usually hear and much louder than what you usually hear, you very quickly get into that state where you're having the experience. It seems real. Add to that 3D and a bunch of other things. And it's a very, very real experience. What that means is that a part of your brain and a part of your mind take that in as being real experience. The question is, do you process it consciously or not? Most movies, certainly all advertising, all political speech, is designed to create within you a response. First, that what you're being told is true and real, and secondly, what you should do with that. And what usually what the politics and advertising is trying to do is make you fearful or make you feel bad about yourself so that you will either buy or take the buy what they want you to buy or take the action that they want you to take. In movies, you have an opportunity to, and in any other way that you can take this in, you have an opportunity to identify with the character and identify with the emotions of the character. And by doing that, have an experience for yourself where you can process it and in effect say to yourself, oh, that's what that would be like. And then hopefully if it's something that's dangerous or bad or in some other way, something you don't want to experience, not have to go there and do that in your life to have that experience. You've already done it. Why do it again? And so few people actually look at it that way. They don't look at it as part of the journey. They don't look at it as another piece to a puzzle, which is your life. Why did you wind up in that room with that particular movie, sitting with that particular person that you went to the movie as your companion so that you could talk about it later? What is it that you're taking in? All of that. There are some people that say that life is a whole lot like a movie, that there's really nothing here. And, you know, quantum physicists are sounding more and more like mystics all the time. Parallel realities. All of the things that we now know about how much, quote unquote, empty space there is. But there's something in the empty space. We just don't understand it. What is matter? If you look for particles, physical matter, you find particles. If you look for waves of energy, find waves of energy, and somehow they're the same thing. We're now learning that what all the mystics have been saying for thousands of years really can be confirmed, if only at this point in a rudimentary way, by science. How cool is that? So, I'm looking forward. I did this as a tee up partly because I'm sure Stephen will go somewhere with it. But giving you, as usual, some food for thought, another way of looking at your experiences, another way of processing your life experience in something simple like a movie. What does it mean? What does it all mean? And that's today's metaphysical musing. And now I have the great pleasure of hanging out with Stephen Simon. You with us, Stephen?
I sure am, pal.
And Stephen and I worked together for a little while, and like everything else, it was a virtual partnership because I was on the East Coast and you were on the West Coast. But we did get to meet over 10 years ago now, I think, and had some interesting times when we got together. And I'm just, you have had a fascinating life and you've done fascinating things. I think we're going to have a great time talking about it.
Well, I look forward to it.
So, and I also want to say how grateful I am that you recently were very ill and you went through that and came through the other side of it and you're feeling good. So I'm very grateful that you're with us and you're feeling good.
Thank you, buddy. Well, as I said to you when we chatted a little while ago, briefly before the show started, there's nothing like dying four times to wake you up and give you a different perspective of life. And I did. 6 months ago, I had a heart attack, and my heart stopped four times, and twice here in the house, once in the ambulance, and then once actually in the loading dock at the hospital. And they told me later on that 90% of the time when that happens, the person doesn't survive. And I'm not, you know, we could spend the whole hour talking about that experience, which I know this is not about, but it does change you, and it has changed me in a very significant way. As my wife, who literally saved my life, and she did that physically that night, and she's done it metaphysically since we met. As my wife says, you know, Stephen not only doesn't sweat the small stuff anymore, he doesn't sweat the big stuff. And right. That's true. You know, it just gives you a different perspective. And, you know, my background is as a filmmaker. I mean, that is who I am as a professional, and it's who I am artistically, and it's what I came to this planet to do. I mean, I was born to a filmmaker. My dad was a producer and a director in the 40s, made movies with Abbott and Costello and Red Skelton and Lana Turner, and he produced the original version of Born Yesterday with Judy Holliday, and he was responsible for developing From Here to Eternity, and as an executive at Columbia, and for putting Frank Sinatra in the film. My dad died rather tragically and suddenly at that point, and Frank Sinatra appointed himself as my godfather, and I grew up with that. I grew up in the film industry, around people who really were the old Hollywood. You know, the Jimmy Stewarts and Henry Fondas and Rosalind Russells and Edward G. Robinson, and my my mother and my stepfather were very close friends with President then Ronald Reagan, then Governor Reagan, then President Reagan, and I spent a lot of time with him. And I grew up in that world. You know, I grew up in the Hollywood world, and for me, it was because I came here to be a filmmaker. And I went through a lot of crazy things and spent a very brief time as a lawyer, which I wasn't very good at, and begged my way into a job with Ray Stark, who was a really legendary film producer, The Way We Were and Funny Girl and Funny Lady and a lot of Annie and a lot of other wonderful films, and learned the film industry from that standpoint from him. And we had a lot of success. My first film that I developed was Smokey and the Bandit, which wound up being a very successful film. And I had kind of a crazy career in Hollywood for a while, and had the ups and downs, and learned all the major ego lessons that anybody in that industry learns, that when you're successful, you have a lot of friends, and when you're not successful, you have no friends. That's in the film industry itself.
Right.
But my focus really has always been, my love has always been what Hollywood calls fantasy films.
Mm-hmm.
And what in my book, which is when you and I first really met 10 years ago,
yeah,
when I wrote The Forces With You about movie messages, my focus has always been on spiritual cinema, which is what I called it in that book. I grew up loving movies like It's a Wonderful Life and Lost Horizons and The Ghost and Mrs. Muir and films like that, because I think that those films are really windows truly into our souls. Those are movies that show us who we can be as humanity when we operate at our very best, and that kind of generated me to make the films in my life that I am the most proud of, which are Somewhere in Time with Chris Reeve and What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams and Cuba Gooding and Annabella Sciorra, and certainly Conversations with God, which I did a couple of years ago, and Indigo, and even to a certain extent Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which a lot of people, I know what kind of audience I'm talking to when the film that I made that they love the most was Bill and Ted, it's Party On, Dudes, and then that's when you and I met, and I went through a lot of self-induced wounds. My career fell apart. I had a bankruptcy. I lost everything. I was really in kind of on the ground, and picked myself up and had a lot of friends help me and kind of got back and started working again. Then the whole thing almost happened all over again. And I couldn't really, after What Dreams May Come, do anything that I wanted to do in L.A. And I kind of left that film industry behind, and L.A. behind, broke again at the age of, what was I then, 55 in 2001. Left L.A., moved to Oregon because of my dear friend Neil Donald Walsh, who wrote the Conversations with God books, who basically said, Stephen, you really have to just focus on spiritual movies, and you're not going to be able to do it in L.A., so you got to leave. And I did. Moved to Ashland. That's where Neil really championed me writing my book. I went on a book tour with the book in 2002, and that led to one of the great loves of my professional life, which is the Spiritual Cinema Circle, which is a business that Gay and Katie Hendricks and I founded. We're now in our ninth year, in which we distribute films that have a spiritual, uplifting, but non-denominational content to people every month. And we've been successful since we started, and we have subscribers in 80 countries around the world and people in every state in the union, and it's something we send out 4 movies a month, and I'm very involved in it and choosing the movies and doing discussions and things like that. And I've kind of lived a life like you've lived and like everybody else has lived, where I've had great highs and great lows, where I've had great successes and great failures. And, you know, I've learned from all of them, and, you know, I'm now at this point in my life where I'm going to be 66 in the end of June. And it's a wonderful time in my life, and I've hit a lot of subject matter here. I mean, I think one of the things that is most important to me right now is a message to people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, which is, you know, we're a generation that isn't going to go away like our parents did, you know, and retire and things like that. And, you know, it's why I wrote my new book about bringing back the old Hollywood and bringing back a certain kind of storytelling. So, you know, that is a kind of a, perhaps longer than you might have wanted, a kind of a summary of what got me to this point.
Well, no, that was a marvelous summary and a juicy one. Thank you for sharing that much of what was going on. You know, you're talking about your spiritual path and your shamanic journey, and that's exactly what I like talking about on the show. But you also have this unique place in American culture, if you will, of being able to create images and stories that affect people's lives, affect the way that they look at life and their connection to spirit and all the rest of it. You know, you kind of skimmed over What Dreams May Come, which I think is one of the most profound movies I've ever seen. And I remember you saying you had to wait 20 years to get special effects that you wanted to do the movie. And one of the things that always occurs to me is, what could you do with that now?
Yeah, a 20-year journey, and it wasn't just waiting for the special effects. I mean, although I think when I look back on it, I think I realized that one of the reasons that it didn't get done for 20 years is that we couldn't really visualize what we wanted to visualize until the technology was available to do it. But most of the reason that it took 20 years is because people thought I was crazy.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, you know, you're going to make this movie about what? You know, it's about this family where the kids die, and then the mother tries to commit suicide, and then the father dies, and then she does commit suicide, and they all meet in the afterlife. Are you out of your mind? And the answer was, yeah. But, you know, it's an incredible love story, which I think it is at its heart, written by my dear friend and mentor, Richard Matheson, who wrote the novel of What Dreams May Come and also wrote Midtime Return, which became the film of Somewhere in Time. And it was an incredible journey. And we could spend the whole hour talking about how all that came about and how it happened, right, and everything else. But, you know, What Dreams May Come is a great example of the kind of film that I personally have just always been attracted to in my life, which are, you know, that film has great polarizing effect on people. People really either love that film or they really loathe it.
Right.
And, you know, I had wildly different responses to that film when I came out. And I think when it came out, and I think when you do that, that is, to me, what you really want to do with art. And it's certainly what you want to do with spiritual movies, which is, you know, you want people to feel something. You want people to get engaged. You want people to have strong feelings about things, and if they have a strongly negative feeling, you know, why? I mean, I remember when we were previewing the film, I mean, we would always walk out, and in the parking lot still, 20, 30, 40 minutes after the film, there'd be people standing around having arguments,
right,
about what it meant. And I think, you know, look, that's great. I'd rather do a film that if you show it to 100 people, 50 people love it, and 50 people hate it, then show it to 100 people and have 100 people go out and say, well, that was pretty good.
Right.
Because that doesn't get us anywhere. You know, that doesn't move you anywhere. It doesn't. So all of the things that I have been attracted to really as a producer or as a director in my life have been things that are going to have that kind of challenge to them.
Well, What Dreams May Come is my favorite love story.
Thank you. Yeah,
for
it's
sure.
A beautiful love story. Thank you.
And part of the reason is the resolution at the end and the whole issue of what is hell and can you get someone out of hell. And I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but your vision of the afterlife conforms to what I understand about it as a healer and doing what I do. And a lot of what I do is helping people cross over. But also this ongoing discussion of what is hell. And I think you totally nailed it, in my experience anyway, from the work that I do, which is amazing. It's an amazing piece of art. So
Thank you. I will tell you, because this will then amuse you. I will tell you that when the film came out in 1998, I was at my friend Gay Hendricks' house. It was about a month, I think, after the film came out or something like that. There was a party at Gay's house, and Gay had a lot of very, very spiritual people in this big room in his house that he used to live in Santa Barbara. And Gay loves to really kind of stick it and have a lot of fun with his friends, and we do that back and forth. And he said, hey, you know, listen, I'm sure a lot of you have seen this new film out, What Dreams May Come, and there's a murmur, and he said, you know, if you have anything you want to say to the producer, he's standing right over there. So I love telling this story because it just illustrates exactly what you're talking about. So the first person that comes up to me is this really, really nice fella, really nice guy. And he said, oh, I'm so glad I get to meet you because I saw this, your film, with a friend of mine who made me promise that if I ever, ever met anybody from the film, because I knew I live in this area, that I would deliver a message. And I thought, okay, here it comes, because I just knew it was coming. And I said, sure, go ahead. And he said, she wants you to know that you are an inhuman monster. And then there was this pause, and he said, I just hope you don't take that personally. <It's> like,
right.
Well, okay. And the reason was because this woman saw the film. Her father had committed suicide.
Right.
And she saw the film as saying, all people who commit suicide go to hell. Now, I can't tell you, first of all, we make great pains in the film to say that there is no such thing as objective hell,
right.
That everybody goes and experience whatever the experience they have is a very personal and individual experience, and it's a choice. It's not a dictum. There is no law that says you have to do this, you have to do that. And I just know, I mean, it's so clear in what the Cuba Gooding character says and how he explains all of the so-called rules of the afterlife. But that isn't what she saw.
Right.
She saw something different. And then Cuba has a great line in the film where he says, you know, look, we see what we want to see. And this is what she felt. This is what she experienced. And right after this young man, I had a lovely woman come up and give me a hug and say, you know, I run a suicide prevention center, and I can't tell you how many lives I think this is gonna save. And then I had somebody else come up to me and say to me, so you call yourself spiritual, huh? And, you know, that's like, okay. And I was like, okay, well, tell me what you're talking about. He said, I just don't know how you get all the money you got to make this movie. And that movie did cost a little bit north of $80 million, mm-hmm. which today is not much, but then was a lot. And he said, I don't know how you get all this money to make a supposedly spiritual movie. And every single image in this film is a Judeo-Christian image. I mean, this isn't spiritual. This is religious. You should be ashamed of yourself. And he walked away. Now, I'm not exaggerating this, David. The very next person after him was a young guy who said to me, listen, I'm doing my thesis in film school on the afterlife and in films about the afterlife. And I want you to know the thing that I find the most fascinating about what dreams may come, is that it's the only film that I have found that didn't use a single Judeo-Christian image in the entire film.
I love it. Hey, Stephen, we're right up against a break.
Go ahead.
I didn't want to interrupt you. We're going to break for a few messages. We will be back in a few minutes. Stay with us with Stephen Simon here on The Farkas Files on Empower Radio.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
Do you have these in a 7.5?
How's that cooked?
Can I get that shipped overnight?
Is there a direct flight?
How long does the warranty last?
What's your soup of the day?
How do you change the ringtone?
Does it come in blue?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life.
Is it raining out?
What time's the meeting?
How much does this cost?
Does it have four-wheel drive?
Have we met before?
What's my account balance?
Yet somehow, when we get to the doctor's office... Any questions?
No.
We clam up. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
When do I get my results?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home. But these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home. I'm home. And I love it. I'm home. I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home, where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury.
Sassy, sassy.
This week's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, Johnny, skipping rocks at the pond sure is fun.
Hey, look, a moving stick.
That ain't a stick, that's a rattlesnake.
Sassy, we're in danger.
Good idea, Sassy. Go get Mr. Gunderson. You will in a second, but first you'd like to tell us something we may not know about animal shelters in the United States?
It's getting close, Sassy!
Approximately 8 million pets enter shelters each year? The majority of which are in shelters because of owner-related issues that the animals have no control over?
Sassy, the rattlesnake! Save us, Sassy!
What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Stephen Simon talking about films and his amazing life. I want to give the call-in number in case we have people that would love to join this conversation. That number is 248-809-3474. 248-809-3474. Give us a call. Ask questions. Let's have some fun. So, Stephen, we didn't get a chance to give out your contact information. How do people find you these days?
Well, they can certainly go to Spiritual Cinema Circle. Go to spiritualcinemacircle.com. That's all one word, spiritualcinemacircle.com. We have a very active Facebook community, and I'm on Facebook there a lot with our subscribers from around the world, around the country. And I think that's probably the best way for people to be able to connect with me is to do so on Facebook.
And I know you also have another website, The Old Hollywood.
TheOldHollywood.com, absolutely. That is a great, that I wrote a book that got published last year called Bringing Back the Old Hollywood, which is, again, a whole other conversation, but it is very much about bringing back the old kind of storytelling and not dealing with all of the visual effects and the big budgets and the big movie stars and things like that. The movie business itself is in such serious trouble, and the stories that you read about it, which put a really good light on it, hide the underbelly of it, which is that financially, as a matter of fact, the head of Disney, Robert Iger, said to a retreat of agents recently from a particular agency that the economics of the film industry no longer work, and unless something serious is done, it isn't going to be around that much longer. And that's really sad, because movies are a very unique, wonderful, beautiful way to communicate. And we, as you said in your musings at the beginning, you know, you can experience a film and experience something as though it were real, and I would say it is real when you have that experience. There's a very recent film called The Tree of Life, which I think comes as close to being a meditation put on film as maybe anything I've ever seen, with a story that really kind of allows you to have your own experience of whatever you might call the divine or creation or things like that. I grew up on movies, and it just dismays me to see what has happened to the film industry, to see what has happened to film. And people who say, well, you know what, I don't go to movies anymore, I'll just watch it on DVD. Well, guess what? Pretty soon, there won't be any movies on DVD, because you can't monetize them if people don't go to movie theaters. Right now, if a film doesn't play in a theater, you can maybe spend $750,000 to make that film at the most. And it would be a shame. It'll be after I'm gone. I don't think we're not in danger for the next 5 or 10 years. But 20 years from now, are there still going to be movies in movie theaters unless something is done? No, there won't be. And I think that will be a great, great sad time for the world, because I think we communicate with each other emotionally through movies in a way that's very difficult to do in any other medium.
That's fascinating to me, because it's such a big money industry. And I would have thought there was a lot of money changing hands and money being made.
There is a lot of money changing hands, but there's the bottom line is horrible. And that's a whole other discussion that you don't want to get into. We're not going to get into now,
right,
because it's
right.
Hard to we would just be able to flick the surface, but the financial model doesn't work.
Right. And that, I know you looked for alternative ways to distribute movies with Indigo and Conversations with God, and you came up with some fascinating alternative ways of getting it out there to a
smaller audience. They played in theaters. You know,
right.
they both did. They both played in theaters.
They played in select theaters. They played in various places in the community.
Yes, Indigo did, definitely.
Yeah. So
yeah, Indigo Indigo was very unique. That was a very unique experience, because that film, which was made for $500,000 under really crazy, and I mean crazy circumstances, really crazy circumstances, we wound up opening that in 100 movie theaters on one weekend, and about 600 or 700 other venues, including New Age churches, yoga studios, and things like that. And the movie, if I remember now correctly, because this is 2003, I think we did about $1,300,000 worth of business in that one weekend, in which we got it into all of those different venues. And then people tried to do that later on after that, and it didn't work. It was a very unique thing. That's not something I think you can do on an ongoing basis. But it certainly worked for that, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, these are the things that I find the most interesting, because many, many years ago, I think it was 2001, my former business partner, Barnett Bain, and I produced a film called Quantum Project, which was the first film to ever debut on the Internet. It was a 32-minute film that we made for a website called Sightsound.com, and it was the first original film to premiere on the internet. It was a fascinating experience, and also a very deeply spiritual film, by the way, a very deeply spiritual film with John Cleese from Monty Python, whom most people would not know, is an unbelievably deeply spiritual man. I mean, deeply so. To me, those are the things that are fun. You know, the things that are risky, the things that are that haven't been done, the things that people tell you you're out of your mind, you shouldn't be doing this. Those are the things that are fun.
Right. Right. But, you know, I have to give you my favorite line from Indigo, though.
Well, which is what?
Which is, oh, Grandpa, you're just dimensionally challenged.
Yeah, I know. That little girl, Megan McCandless, who was nine
incredible.
Then, I have to tell you very quickly, for those of you who are listening who may have seen Indigo and seen Megan, who had never acted before, never even thought of acting before she played the lead in that, and was so incredibly brilliant all the way through. She's now 18, and she's pursuing her acting career, and she just opened in a play in Portland, Oregon, which is very near where I live, and she got the best reviews of anybody in the play, and actually the reviewer for the Portland newspaper said, a star is born with this young woman, and we haven't seen it yet, but my wife and I are actually going to go this weekend and see the play and see Megan grown up.
Fantastic.
Now, the actor that she played with in that film, a guy by the name of Neil Donald Walsh, she'll never grow up. And there's no hope for Neil whatsoever, but Megan has.
Yeah, that's one of my lines. People say, so where'd you grow up? I went, well, I haven't.
Yeah.
But,
and
I was born and raised. You know.
Hopefully we never will. Well, you know, Neil wrote the Conversations with God books, and it is such a dear, 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 dear man. And I talked him into acting in the film, into playing, which didn't take long because he's a ham anyway, but he did a wonderful job, and it was a lot of fun. It was a crazy experience and a lot of fun. I went from making What Dreams May Come, which I think the final budget on What Dreams May Come was $85 million, and the next film I did was Indigo, which was $500,000.
Right.
Which was probably our catering budget on What Dreams May Come. We probably paid that for food. And I have to tell you, it was great fun making that movie for that kind and under those circumstances.
And it's a wonderful movie. So obviously it can be done.
Oh, it absolutely can be done.
So says something about the big budgets that wind up being required for all the movies.
And you know, one of the wonderful things about it, David, that I just get a big kick out of, which is really fun, is that, you know, when you do films like this, you know, when we did Somewhere in Time, when we did What Dreams May Come, you know, very often films like that, you don't know, you know, Somewhere in Time was a total bomb when it came out and, you know, was just vilified by audiences and critics. It was just a commercial disaster, a critical disaster.
And now it's a cult classic.
And now, yeah, see, it takes time. You know, it takes time with a lot of these things. And you don't know what the effect is going to be. Kevin Costner had a wonderful quote that I read that I put in the Bringing Back the Old Hollywood book, which is that you really can't tell whether you've made a successful film or not, really what we should term being successful, until maybe 5 years after it was out. And if you hear that somebody has a friend in their house and says, oh, you know, I have a movie on DVD that you've got to see.
Right.
Then you know you've made something that hangs around, that isn't just Chinese food, that you enjoy it for the minute, and then 5 minutes later, it's completely missing. And you never know the effect it's going to have. And the reason that I brought that up is that Indigo is very much about an Indigo child, and this little girl played by Megan McCandless. And lo and behold, what happened this year on network television? A show that's become very successful, that just got renewed for its second year, called Touch, with Kiefer Sutherland, which is about an Indigo child. And now that's a network television show that is about an Indigo child. And when we did it 10 years ago, people were like, what is that? What? Right. Is that some made-up kind of thing? So I get a big kick out of that.
Right, and Touch is kind of about the other end of the spectrum because he's a withdrawn indigo. He's brilliant, but he doesn't communicate with language, as opposed to the character that Megan played, who was very, very verbal.
Very loquacious, yes.
Very verbal. But it fascinates me partly because it's really talking about the interconnectedness and that apparent serendipitous events aren't, that they're all connected together. Mm-hmm. So to give you an idea, the final episode of Touch, the 2-hour finale, is on now, and I told my daughter, you can't watch it. We're watching it tomorrow night. We're watching it tomorrow night with Susan on Hulu together because I'm not going to come off the show and watch the second half.
Good for you. Yeah, I know. We're gonna watch it tomorrow as well because we tend to tape those things and watch them the next day so we don't have to watch the commercials.
Right, and I always know when you know the corner is turned when I keep mentioning something to my kid, and her thing is when she gets interested in a show, she gets on Netflix or Hulu and watches the entire TV series or whatever it is from the beginning, which means she'll watch 8 episodes with no commercials in a row in an
mm-hmm.
evening.
Which, for her.
Right, which depending on how upsetting and violent it is can
yeah,
be
that's true.
Quite the experience, you know, and it's a wide range of stuff that she likes. But she wants to know the story. She wants to know all the inside stuff. She wants to know the character development and the plot turns and all the rest of it so that when she gets to the present ones, she knows what's gone on. And she just won't let it go. And I finally got her to do that with Touch, and she totally got hooked.
Yeah, so, well, that's a wonderful thing to get hooked on. If you're going to get hooked on a show, get hooked on a show that's about spirituality and the connection of all things, as you said, and that's so well done as that show is, and it's really, really, really well done.
Yep, it's beautifully, beautifully done. So I know that the old Hollywood is kind of a new direction, and it's your approach to people of, in watching my air quotes here, our generation, because I'm only a year younger than you are. Tell us just a little bit about this new direction and what you want to do with that.
Well, this is really, as I said, about saving movies. The very first page of the book is a scenario that I put out there, which is a young girl. It's 20 years from now, and a young girl comes into the living room with her grandparents, and they're watching Turner Classic Movies. And they're watching a one of their favorite films. And she says to them, Grandma, Grandpa, boy, it must have been wonderful to have lived in a time in which they actually still made new movies every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we are at a point where this incredible industry that I love so passionately that I think when we do our job well, we really do touch the heart and the soul of who we are as human beings. Do all these violent, ridiculous, and dumb broad comedies and all those things, does that do that? No. Is it, you know, are they entertaining? Sure. Should they be out there? Of course. Do I have anything against them? No. But when we do our job right, when we do a film like Forrest Gump, when we do a film like Heaven Can Wait, when we do a film like The Tree of Life that I brought up, or City of Angels, or something like that, that really, really gets to the heart of our human experience here on the planet, I think that we make an enormous contribution to our culture and to ourselves as human beings. And I would hate to see the movie industry that puts movies in this theater. And as you talked about, you know, when you're in a darkened place, in a big screen, and you're actually immersed in that experience, that is something that's very uniquely and deeply, can be deeply, a deeply spiritual experience. And mm-hmm. you can experience things through that that really are very difficult to experience any place else. It's an incredibly vulnerable, extraordinary place to be. And I would hate to see people, us, lose the movie business. And I wrote this book, Bringing Back the Old Hollywood, which is available on Amazon, so that I could kind of lay out where the industry has been, where it is today, and where, unfortunately, if we don't do something, it may be going, and why so many people our age, of our generation, have abandoned going to movie theaters, because Hollywood is basically abandoned to us, except for the last 3 months of the year when movies of quality come out to qualify for an Academy Award. And what we can actually, which is what happens, I mean, you know, listen, I think most people who are listening to this realize, who have interest in movies of quality and things like that, very rarely do those movies come out before September of every year. And the first 8 or 9 months, you're kind of flailing around. There's a terrific movie out right now called The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which is a beautiful, beautiful movie, which I highly recommend to people. I have nothing to do with it, but it's a beautiful film, a wonderful film for adults that says an awful lot about our humanity. But this is now June 1st, and, you know, maybe there's been one or two. So at the end of the year, we get them, but the problem is that we get all of them at the same time.
Right.
A lot of them don't do well, and then the industry says, see, people don't want to go see these movies, but people have gotten out of the habit of going. And so I think if you go to theoldhollywood.com and you see what we're doing there and what we're trying to do to make people aware of this, what I'm hoping is that, you know, in the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years, this will have kind of seeped into people's mentality and something will be done about it. As a friend of mine once said to me, Stephen, I have something to say to you. You know, most of the things you do or are interested in, you really are ahead of your time. And, you know, just so you don't think that's a compliment, what that really means, Stephen, is that right now you're wrong.
Well, you're in good company, because
you know,
everybody
like, okay,
that's
well, that's
time.
True, but what can I do, you know?
You're in good company, because everybody who's ahead of their time or a leader winds up in the same position until they realize that you were right and you're brilliant. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure. Listen, that I don't think anyone's ever going to call me as brilliant. But I've made way too many mistakes, and I talk about that in the book, about all the crazy mistakes. And some of the best reviews I've gotten have been people saying, boy, after I read your book, I feel so much better about the mistakes I made in my life, because the mistakes you made a lot more than I did, and they were a lot bigger, and they were a lot dumber. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know what? I take that as a compliment. But, you know, on a serious note about that, I really believe in the theory of you really have to take risks in life. That no risk, no reward, I think is really true. I think the things that we regret in life are the things that we really, really wanted to do but talked ourselves out of. We're afraid of doing, and I'm not talking about doing something that would be illegal or immoral or damaging to somebody. You know, I really wanted to kill that person, but I didn't. Well, I'm not talking about that. You know, I'm talking about the kinds of things that we want to take a risk with our heart or with doing something, and we're afraid of failing. And I have failed a lot in my life, a lot. Bankruptcy, all kinds of things that have happened. I've been married twice that worked out very badly, but now I'm married to the love of my life, and I didn't even meet her until I was 55 years old. And I've made movies that have been, you know, financial and critical disasters, and I mean, I've gone through all kinds of things that have been failures. And I know, David, a lot of people on a spiritual path have a problem with the word failure. Well, there is no such thing as failure. To which I will say, oh, baloney. Of course there is such thing as failure. Yes, there is. Now, of course, when you look back on it in the future, and you've lived through the experience, and if you've learned from it, as they say, when one door closes, another one opens, you can look back on it and say, well, boy, am I ever glad that happened, because it led me to this and it led me to that. So at the end of the day, it wasn't really a failure. I will say at the end of the day, yes, it was a failure, but you learned so much from it that you turned it into a success.
Right.
But it was a failure when it happened. And, you know, you're alive when that happens. And I think today, with all of the fear that there is out there, and there's so much fear, and with this December 21st, 2012 date coming upon us, which a lot of people have feared for decades, you know, and decades and decades and decades, there's so much fear out there that I really think it's important now for everyone who has a spiritual belief to really stand up and to go out and do something risky. You know, take a chance, put yourself out into the world, and, you know, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out, but boy, the effect that these things can have on people, you know, and I just look now at the spiritual cinema circle, you know, this is not something that everybody in the world knows about. It's not something that millions of people know about, but it is something that affects tens of thousands of people every month, and I think that's the best way for me to put it. It affects tens of thousands of people every month. Mm-hmm. And that's great. Things don't have to affect millions of people on a worldwide basis to have an effect in the world. You know, if you affect your community, it's a big thing. So I hope that people, if they do pick up the book, will get from that, you know, I can take risks and it would be a good thing.
Fantastic. And what a great message to end this with. I want to thank you so much for being on. This has been great fun.
Yeah, it's been great fun, Rika. And thank you, David, for everything that you did to help us get on this journey, because you were there at the very, very beginning with the whole thing of spiritual cinema being born, and you were an enormous help with that, and you're a great, great guy, and I will always have a huge place for you in my heart. I'm very, very grateful to you, so for thank
oh,
you
Oh, thank
that.
You so much, because that whole thing was a little ragged around the edges when we were doing it.
But, you know, that's what that stuff is when you start, you know?
Right. So, thank you so much. Again, people can find you at spiritualcinemacircle.com.
Correct.
And at theoldhollywood.com.
Correct.
Stephen Simon, thanks so much for being on the Farkas Files.
Thank you so
much, really
David.
Appreciate it. And I have a project in mind. I'm going to contact you on Facebook. We got to talk.
Okay, pal.
Thank you.
You bet.
So if you want to find me and my work, because I do cool stuff, you can find it at househealing.com. And on the contact page, you will be able to contact me by every conceivable modern technology, including a link that lets you make an appointment with me for free reading and assessment of your situation to see if what I do is helpful for what's going on for you. We're going to have a mystery guest next week. Every once in a while, the schedule just suddenly falls apart and there's a hole, and I'm sitting here going, okay, it's going to be interesting to see who's on the show next week. But sometimes those are the most exciting shows because absolutely fascinating people show up. So we will play it by ear, just as, you know, and Stephen's the perfect example for this. Starting things without having any idea what you're doing, but they always seem to work out somehow. So, I want to come back to the metaphysical musing, as I often do, and just have you think about that idea that all realities are dreams and all dreams are reality. Another way of putting that is as above, so below, as within, so without. What goes on inside of you, however that happens, is what's going to be outpictured into your life. And a lot of what goes on in your life is going to change the way you see things and therefore change who you are. So it's all connected. And it always is all connected. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Thanks for being with us.